they're going to bring to this conversation this evening. So go ahead, give it to Jeff.
Yeah, well, Mark, I'll let you introduce yourself first.
Okay.
All right, my name is Mark Rembush. I'm actually originally from East Africa, so I have a funny accent. I hope you can understand. Can you hear me at the back okay? Because my voice isn't very strong.
Yes, sir. You're great.
You're hearing okay, Mark? My education, as far as it's relevant for tonight's talk, is one where I went to school in England through my undergraduate years, studied physics in college, then did a master's degree in mathematics, and ended up here in California, down in San Diego, studying oceanography for my doctorate degree. And for the last 40 years or so, I've been a professor of oceanography, physical oceanography, that's to say marine physics, at the University of Rhode Island. I've been a professor there during that time, and I'm a so-called emeritus professor, which means they don't pay me anything anymore. I still live in an office, and my office looks something like... Which way around is
it? I think it might be that one. Next one.
Okay.
There we are.
Something like that. Which qualifies me to talk about chaos this evening.
All right. Yeah. And my name is...
Let's go.
There we go. All right, my name is Jeff Still. I'm a deacon here at the church, and my training, I started off as a physics major in college and quickly realized I liked learning about science, not doing science. And so I continued to learn about science ever since then. And then in my master's program at the Fuller, I got a master's in divinity, which does sound like the degree that Harry Potter would get, but it's a real degree, Master of Divinity. And I got to study the philosophy of science, history of theology, and ancient Near Eastern cultures, which I'll be talking a bit about tonight, and of course the Book of Genesis, which is kind of the big question that we're going to get into. And the big question for tonight's event here is... The topic is chaos and creation. We've got two events, by the way. Next week will be determinism and divine action. Get ready, that'll be a wild night. But for tonight, the question is, can a world forged by chaotic forces have a creator? Just as a way of explanation of that question. We often hear, I think, in popular media and news, study of science in school, about science and how the world came into being, the world as we know it came into being. We're not even get a sense that the world came into being really through just random forces. Random events happened and gave us the world as we have it today, and there's not really maybe any purpose behind that. It just kind of happened that way, and here we are. And so that kind of scientific view of the world seems to be sort of a challenge to a religious view or even a spiritual view of the world. And so we're going to tonight just talk about that big question. Can a world forged by chaotic forces, can we even talk about having a creator if that's really the kind of world that we discover? And so when we're talking about chaos, I'll actually sit down at this point because I'm going to hand the big question off to Dr. Mark here. When we're talking about chaos, and as scientific lay people, often we mean, I think, something that scientists don't mean. And so I'm hoping Dr. Mark can share, what do scientists mean when they are talking about chaos?
Okay.
I'll get to that in just a moment, but I want to start off by saying that faith and physics, they're both areas where we're seeking truth, and more broadly, religion and science. Truth is what we're aiming for from very different directions, it seems sometimes, but there shouldn't be any conflict because the truth is one, presumably, and we are seeing it from different angles, but we're both aiming ultimately at the same thing. Getting back to physics, which is my specialty, I don't know much about the things that Jeff knows a lot about, but in the 20th century, there were really three revolutionary theories that changed the world of physics permanently. The first one, of course, was relativity, and then came quantum mechanics, and finally chaos theory. Now, relativity was mainly applicable to the very large scale of the universe, quantum mechanics to the very small scale, the nanoscale of the universe, and chaos theory really goes all the way from the very small to the very large, including the human scale. So it's something that very much interacts with us in our everyday lives. What do I mean by chaos? In ordinary everyday speech, oh, do you have that little device there?
Oh, yeah, please, yeah.
Thank you. Where are we?
That's pendulum slide there.
I was just going to say, in ordinary everyday life, when we talk about chaos, it's something like this picture here, or maybe a process that's random. But in scientific parlance now, we've hijacked the word to mean something a little more specific, and it's something which is orderly rather than disorderly, and it's definitely not random. So we need to wrap our minds around this. It looks random, but it really isn't. There's a hidden order within it, which is what we've uncovered. And in particular, chaotic systems or chaotic processes, in the scientific sense, are ones which are very sensitive to the initial conditions. Typically, those processes can be represented by known equations. And usually, if you have a known set of equations, you can run those equations on the computer if you can't solve them analytically, and you can project forward what the behavior of that system will be. But if it's a chaotic system, a chaotic set of equations, that does not happen, except in a very short time scale. I'm going to show you because of that sensitivity to initial conditions, I should say, is the reason for that. I'm going to show you a video that will make that clear. What this video is, it's a video about pendulums.
Should we just turn it on here?
Oh, okay.
Let's go ahead and introduce it.
Okay. Let me talk about it a little bit first. A pendulum, of course, is just something that's swinging to and fro, is the way we think of it. And a normal pendulum, these are going to be frictionless pendulums. They're ones that are programmed on the computer using the equations. So it's easy to make them frictionless on a computer. So for the first 5 seconds in this video, you're going to see a pendulum that is swinging to and fro periodically. Very simple, very straightforward. After that, for another 10 seconds, you're going to see a chaotic pendulum. That's a double pendulum, which is a pendulum that's attached to the bottom of another pendulum. So one pendulum above the other. And when you do that, you have a chaotic system, it turns out. It's used in most of the starting conditions that arise. Some of them, you can start it in certain situations where it will not behave chaotically. But typically, when you start it in a random situation, it will behave chaotically. You're going to see that chaotic motion of the double pendulum for about 10 seconds, and then there'll be a period where it will just show you the different patterns that can be produced by different starting conditions. And then you're going to see, for about another 10 seconds, two double pendulums, one on the left, one on the right. And the one on the left is the same one you saw before, and the one on the right is almost the same, but it has a very slightly different length of one of the two pendulums. And that very slight difference in length produces an effect which is typical of chaos, where it loses its memory, as it were, of the initial conditions, because although the two pendulums start off moving together very, very quickly, they lose that synchronization and behave quite differently. So watch out for that when you're watching the video. Finally, after that period of looking at the two double pendulums, where you'll see this divergence of their behavior, you'll then get to see a quadruple pendulum, which is a complex system that we'll be talking about a little bit in the sequel. So let's take a look at that right
now. A simple pendulum moves with exact predictability, and its timing is like clockwork. But what happens when you put another pendulum on the end of the first? All of a sudden, beautiful chaos. Its motion isn't at all predictable, and don't bother trying to use it to keep time. Any small difference in its starting position or velocity will become larger and larger differences, leading to an entirely new pattern that no one has ever seen before. Like snowflakes, no two chaotic pendulums are alike. Some look like flowers, others look like wings or rings, and some look like, why don't you tell us what you see by creating your own chaotic pendulum? Just go to MetLabs.io and look for the chaotic pendulum line. There is also a link in the video description. Share your paper creations in the comments, or send us a link on Twitter, or Facebook, or wherever.
That's actually fun if you do that. Yeah. It's still up, so.
Okay. So a prerequisite for chaos is non-linearity. You can only have chaos if the system is a non-linear system. Those of you who are familiar with mathematics will know what I mean by that. But non-linearity isn't sufficient to guarantee chaos by any means, and many non-linear systems do not manifest chaos. And some systems that have non-linearity will behave non-chaotically when they're only slightly disturbed, but will become more towards chaos and eventually switch over into chaos as the disturbance gets more vigorous. So,
That's interesting. And so, yeah, at this point, I think I was going to ask you, I've asked you, how does that non-linearity then fit into the creation from physics point of view of kind of the Big Bang theory and kind of that starting condition and then the world we have now?
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I have a Big Bang slide here that should help with that. I can figure out how to do this. That's the wrong way. There it is. So this is a timeline going from left to right where it goes back to the Big Bang about 13.8 billion years ago. And as you can imagine, when that happened, we had a very vigorous, energetic happening process occurring. And generally speaking, the more vigorous the process, the more likely it is to be chaotic. In addition, the forces are definitely nonlinear. The gravitational and electromagnetic forces are both nonlinear. They're inverse square law forces, 1 over r squared, if you remember, which is 1 over r squared is nonlinear. And so with the nonlinearity and the extreme energetic form, this early part of the universe's history is almost surely highly chaotic.
Wow. And so the question I have, and I wonder if you all have as well, is does that mean that if you rewind the tape to the beginning of the universe again and play it again, we don't end up in the universe that we're in? It's, you know, maybe quite different. Do we even have atoms and stars and galaxies, those kind of things?
Now, it used to be thought until the end of the 19th century that by many scientists that we lived in what was essentially called the clockwork universe, that everything was set from the initial conditions, and because we had Newton's laws of motion and Maxwell's equations, that there was really no room for any variation. And so in that case, what you're saying is that it was an inevitable process from then on. We now know that that's really not a proper description of it. And there are two very definite reasons. So I'm saying no almost definitely to the idea of the universe having an inevitable history. The first one is, of course, that the initial processes of the Big Bang, and even after that, are largely chaotic. And the second one is a very intriguing one, which is that the universal constants that come into our description, the physical description of our universe, such as the gravitational constant, for instance, or the constant that comes into the Coulomb equations that determines the electromagnetic forces, those are just set. We don't know why they have those particular values, they just do. And there are maybe 25 or 26 such constants that have these fixed values, but we don't have any inkling of an understanding of why they have those particular values. The thing that's particularly intriguing to me about it is that those who have made computer simulations of the evolution of the universe find that if those constants were even slightly different, not all of them, but if some of them were even slightly different from what they are in our world, that the possibility of life as we know it appearing is extremely small, or even zero. Our universe is very, very sensitive to the values of those constants, and so one wonders how it comes about that they have those extraordinarily well-chosen values for producing life, not to mention human life. This is often referred to as the fine-tuning of the universe. or sometimes it's called the anthropic principle, that it's something that's well worth reading about. And of course, if the values had been chosen differently, we wouldn't be here to witness it. So the very fact that we're here, as it were, suggests that those constants really were chosen extremely carefully as well. How does this accord with the Bible says about creation?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I mean, what you're saying is there's sort of the two sides in that. On one hand, you have a universe that's very open to possibility, but on the other hand, you also have a universe where all these constants are, in a sense, fine-tuned, that does eventually give us the universe that we really experience, and that's just a lot to wrap your brain around. I'll jump to the next slide here. Science of Chaos and Genesis, then, is an even bigger curveball, and we've got about 5 curveballs for you tonight here, folks, so get ready. But Genesis and creation is really a big question, a really difficult one. The big part of the reason is that Genesis is written in an ancient world. It's an ancient text. And so it's written long before anyone had ever heard of science. It's actually written long before anyone had ever really started to think in what was the scientific way. Probably the earliest you could think of would be the early Greek philosophers, and they come well after, and in a different, slightly different part of the world. There are actually, this is just a picture of different cosmologies that have come into vogue since after Genesis was written. So the one over here on the right had probably the longest, sort of the longest history. It's the Aristotelian model, but this is Dante's version of it from the middle of the late Middle Ages there. You can see Earth is kind of the junky center of the universe. Hell actually is the ultimate center of the universe, which is the farthest you can possibly get from heaven. So, and by the way, people in the Middle Ages did believe in a round Earth. That's a common mythology. But then later we've got the bottom left-hand corner here is Newton's clockwork universe that we already discussed. And then up at the upper left is sort of our, like when I think of the solar system, this is the picture I have in my head. But what I would point out about it is even that is, to some extent, it's abstract. Notice those planets are not the right size. They would be much smaller. There are rings there, which suggests that the orbits of the planets always stay the same. Of course, they don't. They differ slightly. And so even our, quote-unquote, scientific idea of the universe is, in a sense, an abstraction, not a, in a sense, a literal description, but kind of a generalization, an abstract description. Here is, if you go back to the time of Genesis and you visit Israel's neighbors, here's kind of the cosmic geography that they are working with. And we've sort of pieced this, ancient historians have sort of pieced this together. You have a heavenly cosmic ocean. Well, look up at the sky. It's based on observation. Look at the sky. It's blue. Why do you think it's blue? It must be water up there, right? And we've got a lower ocean. The earth and the air turn into sort of like this bubble in the midst of everything. And you've got pillars of the earth holding up the world. What do they rest on? Well, I mean, who knows? You've got the underworld there. And that's what they're thinking of when they're thinking of cosmic geography. An interesting thing about this has to do with chaos is that when they're talking about creation, usually their creation stories start as water. Everything is water. And water is sort of the embodiment and symbol of chaos itself. And not chaos in a scientific sense, but chaos in the sense of disorder. It's inhospitable. It's uninhabitable, even for the, so to speak, for the gods. And so creation proceeds as a process of separating and defining. And so the waters are separated and we get a space in the middle. The earth has to be separated from the water. The Egyptians would talk about the primordial cosmic mound, which would rise from the sea. And so everything kind of has to be defined before it can be inhabitable. And here is, speaking of the Egyptians, here is a picture of an Egyptian picture of what the cosmos sort of looks like. And so for them, the earth is, you can see a god there lying on the ground. He's the earth. He was, as I understand the story, he was sort of a bad god. Another good god decided to beat him up and freeze him on the ground. And he's writhing in agony, and that's why the earth is, of course, so mountainous and stuff. And there's another goddess. She's holding the cosmic waters up, and she has the stars. And there's Ra on his bark, going through the cosmic ocean every day. And so that's kind of their picture. This is probably not what they literally think is there. They're not going out looking for the earth god's nose and trying to find it somewhere. But this is kind of the general idea that they've got in their heads. Another one, Israel's neighbors to the east, the Mesopotamians, they have a similar idea. They've got the cosmic waters surrounding a space of earth. For them, especially, the center of the universe is the temple. And it depends on who's in charge and what city is prominent as to which temple that is at the center of the universe. But that's kind of what they think. And for both the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Canaanites, Israel's other neighbors, creation is also a process of divine, polytheistic divine drama. And so you start off maybe with one or two gods. They procreate or procreate. You know, for the Egyptians, there's a lot of self-procreation. It gets real weird. They have children gods, and then those children gods start fighting, and they fight their parents, and there's bloodshed, and there's destruction. And eventually what you end up with is a world, eventually. But it happens through this, kind of divine process where, the earth's god has, in this picture here, you've got Baal, he is the storm god fighting Tiamat, which is the primordial sea god. And he cuts her in half and puts her guts in the air and puts her body below. And now you've got a cosmic ocean. There you go. And so that's kind of that's the way they're thinking about the world and the universe. It's inhabited by gods. And it's really, in a sense, though, it's based on observation. They're not imagining something to do with the gods that they can't, so to speak, see with their eyes. So just looking out, that's what creation looks like. Looks like we're living in a bubble. Well, let's talk about that. And so then we come to Genesis. Genesis, I'm going to tell you, so there's people who are going to argue with me. I don't know if any of them are here tonight, so you can raise your hand at the end if you are. For Genesis doesn't do, I worded this the way I want it. Genesis does nothing whatsoever to dissuade its first readers of standard ancient Near Eastern cosmic geography. It talks about God creating the waters above and the waters below. It talks about the rakia, or the firmament, the kind of thing holding the waters up. The Psalms will talk about, other parts of the Bible talk about the floodgates of heaven being opened. You get that in the, if you notice in the Noah story, the waters above and the waters below rise up and the waters above come down. And it's sort of returning to that primordial, unordered state of the world. And the thing that Genesis does do, though, is it shows a great deal of concern to challenge the other creation stories of its neighbors. It challenges them, not in their cosmology, but in their mythology, in their theogony. Scholars will talk about Genesis demythologizing creation. And so where, the Canaanites might talk about Shamash, it says Shamash over here. He's the sun god. The Hebrew word for sun is actually Shemesh. Because Hebrew is very close to Canaanite. It'd be like going to New Jersey and talking English to someone there, and they're talking about water. You got to figure out what water is. It's water. So for them, they're here. So Genesis avoids using the word for sun. It talks about the greater light and the lesser light. It avoids using the word for moon. Uraak is a Canaanite god too. It avoids using the word Yam. Yam is, for the Canaanites, that's the primordial sea god, similar to Tiamat, which we saw earlier. And instead it uses the plural of seed, which is yamim. It's clearly, in Hebrew at least, that's clearly not a name anymore. And so that's kind of demythologizing project that it does. But at the same time, it does accept a lot of the cosmology ideas. And so Genesis versus other ancient Near Eastern creation stories, what are the big differences? Well, the similarities are a few, and they're very big. It begins with disorganized water and darkness. Creation is a process of division and definition. Creation produces a divine dwelling, which, you know, for the Babylonians, it's a temple, but for Genesis, the whole world is, in a sense, a temple for God to dwell with humanity. And creation, and so those are the kind of the similarities. But then the differences are, if you're an ancient reader, I think were much more striking. And so it demythologizes the cosmos. God is not identified with any part of nature. God is not part of nature. God is separate from nature, the creator of all of nature. Creation contains no evil, whereas in the other stories, there's a lot of evil going along. Even the sort of good guy gods are plotting evil against other people. This is big. No destinies rule the fates of God or creature. And so for the ancient Near Eastern folks, they're thinking destinies rule the fates of your gods and they rule the fates of you. Genesis totally stays away from that. There are no fates in Genesis. The world is open to possibility. The world that God creates is open to possibility. In fact, God says, he doesn't say, now I'm going to create a cow, now I'm going to create a horse, now, etc. He says, let the earth bring forth animals. Let the earth bring forth vegetation. So in some weird way, the earth has this job to do, which is to bring forth the creation God's calling into being. And humanity is actually elevated by evocation. For the Babylonians, humans are kind of like, they're basically slaves to feed the gods. That's the idea. But humanity is created for evocation. Humanity itself isn't semi-divine, and nature isn't divine. No elevation of a single state. It's a worldwide story. And then God is creator of all peoples and places. And creation is imbued with freedom, which the word they use for freedom is really dominion. God gives freedom. Is like, you've got a job to do. Here's your bit. Add your kind of mark to creation. Creation is sort of rough hewn. Sun, get up there in the sky and have dominion over the day. Humanity, have dominion over the animals and plants. Let's make something together, in a sense. Big question, is Genesis wrong? If you're looking at it for a picture of what the world is, the universe really looks like, I'm going to say yes. It's not accurate. Big question is, did the Israelites or any ancient Near Eastern person expect accurate cosmic geography from their creation stories? I'm actually going to say no. And I think a lot of scholars would say, not really. That's not really their expectation. I think if you go back and you talk to the folks about Shamash and tell them, well, actually, you know, the sun, it doesn't go around us, we go around it. We're actually spinning at about 22,000 miles an hour around the sun. We've got this huge orbit. The sun's so far away that you couldn't possibly get there, etc., etc. They would probably come away going, well, that's really interesting. Maybe Shamash should be a little higher in the pantheon than I thought he was. It's not going to reorient their entire belief system just because they've got extra information about the way the world works. And so I don't really think that's their expectation. And there's a... We can go, I can show slides for this later, I cut them out, but, you know, throughout the history of the church has always said that the Bible sort of accommodates itself to the understanding of people in the time. And so that's been an ancient doctrine of the Christian church, actually. Big question that I'm really trying to get to is this. Is there any consonance, any resonance, any harmony between Genesis and science? These are the things that I see. There's a lot of answers to this question, a lot of ways you could go, but these are the kind of things I see, especially in regard to chaos theory. One is that chaos, creation is natural. It's not semi-divine realm of gods and monsters. It's in a sense natural. It's running on its own. Creation is a process of order arising from undifferentiated and inhospitable primordial matter. That That's an interesting insight that actually a lot of ancient peoples had. Even, for instance, like Buddhists, Hindus, and Taoists have a similar idea in their cosmology. But for Genesis, creation has freedom. God calls forth a creation that has the freedom to, in a sense, self-organize, to go its own way. Creatures have callings, not destinies. Kind of the same idea there. And then creation matures. That was a big idea that the theologians of the Middle Ages had. They looked at that story, you know, God just says, says to the earth, bring forth animals. And they said, well, actually, it seems like, actually for Augustine and Augustine as well, who's a patristic, he's from about the 5th century. And so they looked at that kind of idea and said, well, it looks like God actually, what he does is create the germs, in a sense, the seeds of creation, the seeds of what is going to grow into the world as we have it, rather than completing something that's fixed and finite and finished. I would say the scientific story of the world rising from an unordered primordial state and developing into the world we see today, that scientific story, is not necessarily, I'll give that caveat, it's not necessarily at odds with the spirit, as it were, of Genesis 1. The spirit of Genesis 1 actually, in a weird way, I think kind of resonates with that story, has room for it. But that's what we're here to really talk about. So that brings us to another big question that I've...
Could I interrupt there and say something?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, please.
What I wanted to say was this, that sensitivity to initial conditions, it's an intrinsic feature of chaos, is something which, particularly when you combine that with the intrinsic, what appears to be the intrinsic randomness in quantum mechanics at the nanoscale, those two in combination, and this is very speculative, but it occurs to me that this could be a way in which God or the divine being can intervene in human affairs without interfering with the laws of nature. Because there's sensitivities, and plus that randomness of quantum mechanics, apparent randomness, because it's that from within the closed system of our universe, it's definitely random. There are ways to prove that. But from an agent outside, it might not be. And so it's as it were that the divine being could exert some control over the progression of this universe. It's not as inevitable as the clockwork universe made it sound, and it can come about in that curious way. But that's pure speculation.
Mm. Yeah. And the related big question I want to ask you about, which is something I always want to ask physicists about ever since, probably I read Jurassic Park, probably, is self-organization. This big idea that lay people hear about, and it sounds so fascinating, but I'm sure I don't understand it. But that's something you mentioned before. I was wondering if you see any connection between that and a self-organizing world.
Yeah, this self-organization is something that comes up when you have chaotic systems that are more complicated than, say, the double pendulum. If you add, because remember we went to a quadruple pendulum briefly at the end of that video, but then when you go more complicated still, you can have what's called spatio-temporal chaos. And in fact, we live in an example of that. Our weather systems are spatio-temporal chaos. And the fascinating thing about those complex systems is that sometimes, for reasons we don't fully yet understand, those systems self-organize themselves into simple patterns. An example that comes to me from my own field of physical oceanography is what's called Baynard convection. And this happens when you put a pan of water on your stove and turn on the gas, that when it's heated from below, you get, of course, convection happening in that pan. But it will organize itself if you keep things very still and don't stir it into little cells, hexagonal cells, that make a distinct pattern. And Jeff has just shown me this evening this picture up in the top right there, which is apparently a photograph taken of the north pole of Saturn, did you say?
One of the poles, depends on which direction you're facing.
And you can see it has a sort of a hexagonal edge, suggesting that might be one of these Baynard cells. But a more everyday example of this kind of self-organization, which is in the realm of biology, is birds flocking, and they flock together into great assemblies of birds. That is a self-organizing process that is intrinsically chaotic. And in fact, people who study this have more or less devised what the rules are that each individual bird is obeying in order to create the overall flock. And that's another example of self-organized chaos.
Mm. And so, so what I hear is you start with what seems like randomness. You get chaos, and then somehow chaos somehow leads to something that actually has an organization to it. I'm thinking of like crystals forming. You've got just a random set of chemicals, and they turn into these.
That's another good example.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That kind of is a lot to wrap my mind around. That's curveball number four, maybe. Wow.
I have a question on that.
Oh, yeah, please.
Just a follow-up. It sounds like even though it's different chaos systems, that the same patterns emerge, like these hexagonal patterns, like they all converge with the similar patterns. Is that something that is beyond the chaos system?
Yeah, it self-organizes itself into those hexagonal patterns. And one of the reasons for that, undoubtedly, is the same reason that honeybees make hexagonal cells in their honeycombs, because you can fit hexagons together without any space in between them. And so there's a tendency. It isn't usually just a solitary Bernard cell like it is at the top of a cell. It's usually a whole group of them, like over on the top left in that picture. Or if you had your pan on the stove, if you looked at it carefully, you'd see that the whole top of it was covered in many, many of those cells. The actual size of the cells would be determined by the things like the depth of the pan and the amount of heat difference between the surface and the bottom.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So still taking a question. I have one more on the self-organization. Just thinking about how that fits with the idea of entropy, because we're looking at chaos theory and that tendency towards randomness, that's the existence in the universe. Is that going to be a stable state, or is that something over which entropy eventually going to run over?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think, you know, there's a law in thermodynamics that says entropy inevitably in a closed system is going to increase. So if there's an entropy meaning disorder, and insofar as these self-organizing systems are creating order, there must be outside that system an increase in disorder to compensate for the order that's being developed in the self-organization.
And that really brings us to the last question I want to ask you is, what about chaos? And we started with the beginning of the universe. How about the end of the universe?
Oh,
where does that come?
Let's see.
Tell us the bad news now.
You know, we've been around for about 14 billion years, and let's see, if I go back, how do I go back? I keep doing this backwards. Is it this way? Yeah, you notice that there's a slight curvature to the edge of this. You see it's curving up here and curving down there. What that means is that the universe, as it expands, is actually expanding more and more rapidly. There's an acceleration in the expansion. That's only been discovered fairly recently. And it disappointed a lot of people, because many people thought that there might be a deceleration, and that what would happen would be that after expanding for a few more billion years, that the whole thing would collapse again into a singularity, and we'd have a sort of a repeat of another Big Bang, and the whole thing would repeatedly form and re-emerge. So, but that does not seem to be on the cards. So we have this rather dismal future for the universe, where we expand and everything gets further and further apart, colder and colder, and more and more lifeless. But before that...
Sorry.
Before that happens, the worst thing is going to occur. This is the sun. Our sun is one of the main sequence stars, and we know what happens to main sequence stars. They burn up their hydrogen fuel, and they get larger in radius over time, get more luminous as they expand, and that means that our sun, in about another 6 or 7 billion years, will have expanded to the point where it's enveloping some of the inner planets, and some people think it might even get as far as enveloping planet Earth. But long before it actually does that, the temperature is going to get so high on our planet that the oceans and all water will boil away, the whole planet will be sizzling hot, and so that's the future we can almost surely expect unless we can escape from our planet eventually.
Show the picture. Welcome home. There we go.
But we might have a fate that will end our period on the Earth quite differently and long before this. For example, about four to five billion years ago, our moon was formed by a body that was set about half the radius of the Earth colliding into the Earth, and from the debris created material that coalesced into our moon. Something like that could happen again. If it did, it would almost surely spell the end of life on our planet. It would be far more serious than what ended the life of the dinosaurs 63 million years ago, because that was only a relatively small body colliding in the Yucatan Peninsula. This is something vastly bigger, and it would be totally destructive. So this is those are three possibilities. There are many others out there, like diseases that would spread and
where's the hope, Mark? Come on, dog.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You were going to ask about the Bible. So we can also talk about what the Bible says as well. What he's talking about does remind me of the old American folk song, which goes something like, "God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, but fire next time." Revelation does talk about the world ending and starting over again. The picture at the end of Revelation is a new heavens and a new earth. Revelation in many ways actually brings back images from Genesis creatively into the story it's telling. And one of the images actually is that primordial ocean, the idea of sea as the symbol of disorder. And right there in Genesis, or Revelation, I think it's chapter 4, the heavenly throne vision, where he says, "There in heaven stood a throne with one seated on a throne, and in front of the throne there is something like a sea of glass, like crystal." And so it's like the primordial ocean has now been totally subdued before the throne of God. And then
It's been self-organized
into a plate. And then I saw a new heaven and new earth. So we got a new heaven and new earth. This is the Christian hope here. "For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more." And so I don't think that if we're really expecting a new heaven and a new earth, we can expect it to be literally without an ocean. Revelation is it's an apocalyptic. It's speaking in many has a lot of symbolism in the language, but it's talking about there's no more disorder. That kind of primordial disorder that had been there at the first has now been subdued and, in fact, removed from creation. And the reason for that is the same reason for creation in Genesis 1, that there, and "I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'See, the home of God is among mortals. God will dwell with his people.'" And so that's really, that is the Christian hope, actually, is that the world does actually get renewed. It just as Jesus came back to life, the whole world is going to come back to life. And these are the only two pictures of those two scenes I could find online that weren't insanely cheesy. So Christian art about Revelation is really bad. I just want to say that. Anyway, there's kind of one artist's depiction of that from a couple centuries ago. So
Going back to Genesis 1,
yeah, please.
I want to say this. I think one of the impressive things about it from a scientific point of view is that it has the right order, what we know to be the true order from science, of creation, where you have the sun and the moon first, and then you have vegetation, you have sea creatures, and land creatures, and then man.
And that's the correct order. And that's the way it really happened. Not in 1 week, but in a much longer period of time. Mm-hmm. So it's intriguing that they got that correct.
Yeah. Well, what we're actually going to do now is we're going to leave. You're going to be like, that's kind of a hanging chat, all of that. Well, exactly. Because the goal of tonight actually is that we sit down and have conversations with one another and kind of work these things out, talk more. We're actually going to have Dr. Mark, he's going to come around the room and poke his head in at different tables. And each group will have a discussion leader and a series of questions that we'll be looking at. But before we do that, I do want to open the room to questions. If there's one big question you're like, before we discuss anything, I really need to have that answered. That's what we're looking for. So yeah, please.
Am I allowed to ask one?
You can ask two.
Well, so the first thing I wanted to ask about to Mark. So you said something about along the lines of it being proven fundamental randomness in quantum mechanics. Are you referring to Bell's theorem there?
Yes, exactly.
Well, a follow-up question to that then. As I understand it, it isn't necessarily the case that quantum physics proves that the physical laws are fundamentally, or physics is fundamentally non-deterministic, because, well, what Bell's theorem says is there are no local hidden variables, but there could be non-local variables. So one theory is called pilot wave theory, which is a fully deterministic interpretation of quantum physics. So I don't know if you could address that.
I've heard of pilot wave theory. I've never read about it. I don't know what it is. But I thought it wasn't so much that it was a local influence that was excluded. But I thought it was if you have a closed system, where nothing can enter from outside, but within that closed system, that there is intrinsic randomness from Bell's theorem. Is that not correct?
I don't know if I could explain it off the top of my head. It's very complex. But I don't fully understand it myself. Mm-hmm. This is just, I'm just going off the things that I've read.
Well, I don't either. My physical oceanography is far removed from quantum mechanics. And
my knowledge
of quantum mechanics isn't very deep.
I know this isn't your area of expertise. Yes. But
that's my understanding. And so if it's just in a closed system that is intrinsically random, that still leaves open a possibility of something that's outside that closed system, such as a divine entity, being able to, as it were, pull the strings on those processes.
But as I understand, pilot wave theory is a fully deterministic. It's by no means proven, but it's. I think there are something like 10 different interpretations of the mathematics of quantum physics, mm-hmm. at least.
Right. Right. Yes.
The pilot wave theory is just one possible. Mm-hmm. But it's. If it were true, it would be fully deterministic. Mm-hmm. So. Not random at all.
As I understood it, being really interested in this question too, the jury's out. So, as in that there are different, like you said, there are different people will say it is certainly random, it is still deterministic, and so you get a few different views there. So, Ben,
do you guys have different? Are there different categories of chaos, and what are the different names for those categories? Entropy, or non-order.
One of the ways that you can categorize them is by the number of dimensions that are involved. You have to have, in addition to time, you have to have at least three dimensions in order to have chaos. A simple pendulum only has two, because at any moment it has a certain displacement and a certain velocity. That's just two dimensions. So it cannot be chaotic. But now when you add a pendulum to a pendulum, you now have four variables, because you have displacement and velocity for each of those two pendulums, and so the possibility of chaos arises. But now you can go to higher and higher dimensions, such as when you get into the complexity theory and the spatio-temporal chaos. So each dimensional form has its own particular flavor, as it were. So you could sort of categorize different chaotic systems by the number of dimensions that represent them. Would be the first thing I would think of.
What about chaos in a closed system, and then you have the chaos outside that closed system? What are the words you used to talk about that?
You mean when they're interacting in some way?
Yeah, like it's hiddenly interacting.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch what you said.
So you have chaos in the whole thing that you could map out, but then you have chaos outside that system that you can't necessarily map out. And so what do you call that? Or what do you call those two categories? You know, like entropy, what's entropy versus chaos?
Entropy is a sense of measure of disorder. A chaotic system doesn't imply high entropy. It's not high disorder. It looks like it's disordered because it looks so random, but it really isn't. It's completely ordered, except for that uncertainty about the initial conditions. And I don't know what more to say about that particular one. Next question.
I had a couple of questions. The first one is just a clarification. You mentioned there's like 25 constants. Is that just, when you're referring to that, is that just the laws of the universe, like gravity and stuff like that?
Things like that.
Okay.
They're usually expressed as dimensionless ratios, like the ratio of the force between two protons due to gravity and electrical repulsion. What's the ratio of those two forces? That's one of those 25 variables, for example. And there are many others, some of them quite subtle. But they're all very important.
Thank you. And then, this is really fun. Thank you for doing this. But then the other question I had was in regards to friends we may have, mostly, usually Christians, very conservative Christians, who kind of believe in more of like a young earth theory. And I thought it was interesting that, you know, basically we started off this, you kind of started from the Big Bang, and you would have lost a lot of people. You know, people, you know, may have walked out or something. So when we're talking with friends like that, what do you think that people like that need to hear to start to listen to these ideas?
I'm very sad about this issue because I think that Christianity is losing some of its proper influence over the next generation or two because so many of our fellow Christians, whom I love and cherish, their insistence on that kind of literal interpretation, when I think it's erroneous. And I think that when it becomes more and more clear that kind of thing is wrong, there's a great danger that people will abandon Christianity completely, having found this too hard to accept. And I think that would do a great disservice to the human race.
I think John H. Walden has done. He's an evangelical scholar of the ancient Near East. I think he's done a lot of good work on that, and has some helpful language around that. His real devotion is to Bible and biblical truth, and he makes strong. I think some pretty strong arguments that at least maybe they won't convince someone, but at least open someone's mind to the possibility that maybe they haven't understood the book of Genesis properly. That God actually has something else to say in it than what maybe people tend to think from a surface reading. I would point out that the hyper-literalist reading of Genesis doesn't come into vogue until really a few centuries ago. So it's not like there as the main voice within the church in history. I actually have some quotes I can give you from 220 AD that give a very strong words against literal interpretation. So,
from Origen, is it?
From St. Origen, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, please.
So you didn't say anything about the marine physics that you do your work in, but it is. It seems whatever the word is I'm looking for. We ended with the sea being a metaphor of chaos. And I'm curious how that relates to you personally in your work and what you're doing with the seat.
You're talking to me.
What are you
going to think? Yeah, the seat that Jeff was talking about was this crystalline seat. It was almost like a block of ice, I think, is it?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
So smooth. But the seat I work with is definitely highly chaotic. It's very turbulent, just like the atmosphere is very turbulent. So, in fact, a very fine example of self-organization in the atmosphere is a hurricane. It's a very good example of a definite pattern emerging out of a chaotic system. So, and in the ocean, you can sometimes get similar things. You can get eddies in the ocean. They're very, very much, very quite ubiquitous near the Gulf Stream, near off where I live in Rhode Island, and off the Kuroshio in the Pacific here. So there's strong chaos in the ocean. And the place where I've myself done a little research on this is in connection with El Nino, which is an ocean-atmosphere interaction, which you've probably all heard of, because it controls weather in this part of the world quite strongly. And that appears to have very definite chaotic behavior, fairly low-dimension chaos, which makes it very manageable.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if this is on. I think that should be our last question, unless there's any other burning questions. Okay, let's see how much time we have, actually. I don't even know what time it is very much.
8:45.
We only have about 15 minutes for conversation. I'm sorry, guys. It got too heated up front here. We're going to just break right straight into... but if anyone needs to use the restroom or grab some water, please do. So...